On today's episode, Bradley Zimmer gets the call in Cleveland. Will he finally solidify that outfield in Ohio? And will he become an all-star sometime in the near future? Plus, guest co-host Zach Kreiser of Baseball Prospectus helps us review the minor moves of the last few days, including Robinson Cano's injury, Sean Manaea's return, and the mystery of Grant Dayton. It's the DFA Podcast. Welcome to Episode 7 of DFA, a podcast from Baseball Prospectus. I'm Brian Grossnick of BP, and today we're mixing things up a little bit. My regular co-host, RJ Anderson, is off today. See you soon, RJ. But we've brought in a special guest co-host to join Sean and myself. Joining today is Zach Kreiser, a fellow author of Baseball Prospectus, and a great sport in coming on the show and being my partner for today. Zach, how are things going?
Oh, things are good. Things are good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. I'm excited to have you on. You joined the Baseball Prospectus family a couple of months ago after some time at Beyond the Box Score. But for anyone who doesn't really know you, you know, a lot of baseball writers have like a particular beat or a hashtag brand. So do you want to just share a little bit about like what your favorite areas of inquiry in baseball are for anyone who doesn't know you or your writing?
Sure. I definitely don't have a hashtag brand or a brand. I do not have many hot takes. My brand is mostly writing way too many words about things that people may or may not be interested in. No, I tend to just go for things that are very uncertain or unclear, like pitch mixes and arm slots and things that you can't find any answer for, which might be a disguise for my lack of ability to find answers. But no, I do try and delve into things that are unclear, that are just curious. And so that's what I've been trying to do at BP so far, a couple months in. So it's fun.
You've got your column. It's called Circle Change. So people can go ahead and check that out. And we'll give a link or two to one of your pieces in the show post when we get this up online. So today, the big move. It's been only a couple of days since our last show, and there have been a couple of medium-sized moves. I wouldn't say there's been a groundbreaking trade or, you know, signing or even that much of a debilitating injury. So the biggest move is probably a move that the Cleveland Indians have made, where they've called up Bradley Zimmer. Zimmer's a top 100 prospect, has been for a couple of years. And looks like the Indians are ready to make that move and bring him up to the major leagues, despite some kind of questionable performance back in 2016. So Zach, I'll throw it to you first. Do you want to talk a little bit about Zimmer and what you expect from him going forward in 2017?
Sure. I mean, I think the number one thing is maybe not even about Zimmer, but that they had been playing Lonnie Chisenhall in center field and Abraham Almonte, you know, was playing. And that's a situation where you have a very low entry to like finding a better player to put out there. And I think, you know, I'm not a prospect evaluator or a scout type or anything, but from what I've read, Zimmer is, if nothing else, supposed to be a good defender, has potential to stick and be good at center field in the majors. And that alone seems like an upgrade for the Indians. I mean, you just don't see many contending level teams with absolutely no answer in center field. We obviously see that with the Tigers right now, but the Indians are a level up from that, who were playing a guy who couldn't take third base anymore 2 years ago, moved to right field, and then was suddenly playing center field this year. And so bringing him up had very little downside to me. You talked about his struggles in 2016 at AAA when he was bad and was striking out. He was striking out some obscene amount of the time, 33%, something like that. And then he comes up to AAA again this year and looks apparently totally different. His stat line looks totally different. The strikeouts go down to normal human levels. And he had about the same number of plate appearances as he did in AAA last year. So I think even if you're looking at a situation where it takes him 200 plate appearances in the majors to get on that even offensive footing, there's just really no way you can think about the Indians going into the second half of the season with no good defensive center fielders. So you might as well give him those 200 plate appearances now to see if he can figure out the offensive stuff.
Yeah, and, you know, especially with the Indians who have been just, you know, cursed when it came to the outfield over the last couple of years. Right now they've got Brandon Guyer, Austin Jackson, and now Almonte was banged up. He'll spend some time on the disabled list. So they've really had some terrible luck with the different people out there. You were talking about Chisenhall playing center field, and while he had pretty good defensive numbers as a right fielder, he's not a center fielder, obviously. And with Michael Brantley as the other kind of regular outfielder, it's not like there's a real need for a good defensive center fielder who can cover some ground and maybe make up for some of the deficiencies that Brantley has moving around these days. So I think this is a really interesting move. Zimmer's kind of an interesting prospect to me in that he's one of those types of guys who, sort of similar to what we talked about with Ian Happ last week or on last episode, he's one of those guys that doesn't have a particular, like, really standout tool. He's good across the board. He's got a good hit tool. He's got some power. Where we thought he had some power last year, it completely disappeared in AAA. It's come back this year. He's got some good speed. He's stolen over 30 bases in a season in the minor leagues. He can play some defense. So he's one of those guys where you've got the opportunity, either everything's going to come together and he might be better than the sum of his parts, or the other thing could happen where he's kind of less than the sum of those tools if nothing really plays up. He's kind of had an up and down road as a prospect. He's gone up, he's gone down the prospect rankings. Now he's kind of leveled out. Do you see him as being something like, you know, again, you established you're not really a prospect guy, and Lord knows I'm not either, but do you see him kind of being a first division starter, maybe a second division starter, or is it really just kind of too early to tell?
It's hard to tell with the type of player now that, you know, the major knock on him, I from my impression, is the swing and miss and just whether that is going to allow the power to play in the majors.
Right.
And that is literally almost every center field prospect who comes up now. And so I don't know exactly how to differentiate between the two other than to see how much that plays in the majors, you know, whether it's something where every major league pitcher is going to spot the hole and just pound him there until he can't do it anymore, or whether it's like a Jock Peterson situation where there's a huge platoon problem and he can only play half the days or something like that. But it, based on the defense, sure, I like him to stick and to be, I don't know about a first division starter, but a starting player. And if you throw in the speed, which is something that you would think plays, it's never really fluctuated. He stole 44 bases across all levels in 2015 and then 38 bases across all levels in 2016, and he already had 9 in AAA this year. So that's a tool that should help him at least level off and be an asset on offense. But even if you look at guys like Jackie Bradley Jr., who've had just these huge swings in offensive production, sometimes you just have to hope that they find some sort of equilibrium, or you live with it because of the defense. And I'm certainly not saying he's going to be as good as Jackie Bradley Jr. at defense, but any defense in center field he can offer right now is probably going to be good enough for this season.
Yeah, and I think that the Indians would be very happy if he turned out to be Jackie Bradley Jr., even as bad as Bradley's been in 2017 so far. That would still probably be a win for the Indians. Just to point out your comment about his strikeout rate, so far in Bradley Zimmer's major league career, he has struck out in every single plate appearance he's had. So right now, we maybe have not found a way to fix this issue. He went 0 for 3 last night with 3 strikeouts. Not exactly what he would have hoped for, but on the bright side, there's nowhere to go but up, hopefully. Unless, I guess if you did that for like 3 or 4 consecutive games, that would actually be worse than
that would be bad.
Yeah. So, all right. So Bradley Zimmer comes up. Just to talk about the Indians for a second, they've had a couple of injury issues with Kluber. Their starting pitching really hasn't worked out too well. Carlos Carrasco had that pectoral issue that pulled him out of a game a couple of days ago. Do you think the Indians need to do something, or are they good just kind of stay in the course and seeing how things play out in a American League Central division that, what's the best way to describe it, is not good, is really, really bad this year?
They should win the division going away, and that's all fine. It offers them flexibility to see what they can rustle up out of the minors before they go crazy. I'd be really hesitant to say that the Indians should go do something because of how much they gave up in assembling the team last year with the Andrew Miller trade and everything. So I'd kind of say no, they shouldn't really go do anything crazy. Maybe they can figure out what's going on with Clevinger as a starter. Maybe they can rustle up something else out of the minors for another weakness. I know you want to talk about Yandy Diaz in a minute, so I'll leave that to you. They have another prospect down in the minors who named Greg Allen, who is an outfield type, who may offer. I think he's probably a corner outfield type. I don't think people see him as a center field guy long term, but he's a basically high OBP hitter with not much power, but with some speed. Looks like he has a mature approach and doesn't strike out very often. I think he could be someone who you see in some sort of part-time role by the end of the season in Cleveland as one of those corner outfielders, assuming that, you know, Lonnie Chisenhall, Abraham Almonte, Brendan Guyer, like none of these guys take the leap and become some star player. I think you might see some reinforcements there. And then you just have to look for the starting pitching depth to hold them over. And I don't think that's necessarily worth, you know, clearing out the farm even more.
Right. And you have to think, I mean, watching Danny Salazar pitch, he's been very home run prone this season. You have to think that'll kind of right itself a little bit, even though he doesn't look like the Danny Salazar we were seeing earlier in the season or even last year. That might fix itself. The Mike Clevinger thing, as fans of the show, if they exist, no, I'm a huge Mike Clevinger guy. I'm really excited that he's still holding this rotation spot with almost an 8 walk per 9 rate. So it'll be really fun to see if he can actually be an effective major leaguer while continuing to walk the planet. So yeah, let's go ahead and move on to our batting practice segment, where we'll do some not so quick hits on all the minor moves that have happened over the last couple of days. We'll bring Sean the producer on to throw a couple of softballs our way. And Sean, are you gonna kick things off with more Indians talk for me?
I am. We have a Cleveland move that happened at the exact same time Zimmer got called up, and that was Sean Armstrong being called up to the majors and Yandy Diaz being sent down.
So this is one thing that hopefully you'll learn, Zach, this year. 2 years ago, I worked on the Baseball Prospectus Annual writing about the Cleveland Indians. And when you do that sort of thing, you really get several guys that really like speak to you out of all the research that you have to do on these players that you never wind up, you know, knowing about otherwise. And for me, two big guys, there were really three guys for the Indians. It was Clevinger, Yandy Diaz, and Sean Armstrong, who really like warmed their way into my heart. Armstrong is this hard throwing reliever who still hasn't seemed to have gotten too much of an extended look in the major leagues, but he touches 100 miles an hour with his fastball, so I always thought he could come up and be an effective end-of-the-bullpen kind of guy. And then Diaz, who's a freak when it comes to getting on base and playing defense, but really doesn't seem to have too much else in the way of a skill set. I'm really excited about Diaz getting an extended look as a utility guy, but it looks to me like the Indians are going to send him up and down. I'm just glad they've switched over to him being their defensive-minded infield guy rather than Giovanni Urshela, who I think has maybe even less offensive upside than Diaz. So I'm disappointed to see Diaz get sent down, but I have a feeling he'll be back sooner rather than later. But Armstrong, I think, could eventually be interesting. He does have some command issues, but he's got real premium velocity. So I would like to see him get an extended look in that Cleveland bullpen, and maybe he could be a guy who could spell the other guys at the end of the Cleveland bullpen, who Terry Francona seems to work pretty hard on most seasons, the Cody Allen, Brian Shaw, and Andrew Miller triumvirate. You have anything interesting about these Indians guys, or is this just another classic case of me getting too excited about guys who really don't matter in the grand scheme of things?
My main thought is that Sean Armstrong is joining my club of guys whose nicknames I would like to coin. and his nickname should obviously be Stretch, and he does not have a nickname on Baseball Reference at the moment. So he is joining the club that currently only includes Rob Zastrzyzny, who I am attempting to nickname Young Scrabble.
Young Scrabble. I like that. That's really good. All right. So we'll make a running list of Zach's designated nickname guys. We've got two on it so far. And if anyone listening has some more suggestions, please don't hesitate to let us know. But yeah, so that's really Young Scrabble, I think, is really good, especially if you take the O out of the Young. Or yeah, that's going to be a really good one. All right, Sean, what else you got for us?
So moving on to a team in the AL West, Robinson Cano hit the disabled list a couple days ago. He's having one of the best seasons of his career. He's batting .296 with a .362 OBP and slugging .533 in 152 plate appearances. So what are the Mariners going to do with all these injuries?
Well, they're going to lose some baseball games. This is crazy. Robinson Cano never gets injured. So this is the one thing that you expected wouldn't go wrong for the Mariners, and now it kind of has. So, yeah, it's just a bad situation. It's very rare to see Cano miss any extended period of time. I don't know. What do you think, Zach?
I think it is impressive that they finally had to dig into their roster so much that they didn't bring up someone with long hair. and that would be Mike Freeman, who finally came up. I think Taylor Motter is probably going to get the time at second base, maybe. And he, of course, still has long hair. But so now you'll have Taylor Motter and Ben Gamel and all of these people who did not expect to be playing for the Mariners. But they can't catch a break, and they're not playing terribly for what is happening to them, but it's not good.
Yeah, and Cano, you know, I think that it's pretty much a given at this point. He's on track to be a Hall of Fame player. There's no real questioning that, I don't think, at this point. All he needs to do is survive for another three or four seasons, and he's probably going to make the Hall of Fame. I will go out on a limb and say, I think that this Robinson Cano deal worked out pretty well for the Mariners, all things considered. I don't know. Is that too hot of a take? Am I burning up the internet by saying that the Robinson Cano deal was probably a good deal, even, you know, considering this injury and everything?
No, he had the one down-ish season for him, and he came back from that and has been Robinson Cano, and they're in a period where they're contending, or, you know, thinking about contending. I think the only real way that it went kaput is if his time in Seattle also corresponded with just a total rebuilding time where it was just money on the books and everything like that. And so I think he's serving his purpose, and that it will end up looking like a reasonable deal, assuming this doesn't turn into some, you know, multiple year nagging injury. It seems like it's working out just fine for them, honestly.
Yeah, it's been a grand total of 16 wins above replacement over his 3 years and change in Seattle, and you really can't argue with that too much. I mean, that's a level of performance that's pretty much commensurate with what he was doing during his, quote, prime in New York, kind of accepting a little bit of a downturn in 2015. So he's doing well. It's just it'd be nice to see him back on the field after he recovers from this injury.
And for all of the ideas that the Jack Z administration tried to do before Jerry DePoto, this is the one move that really has hit and stood the test of time.
Yeah, no question, Sean.
Moving forward now, we stick with the Mariners, and we see that Steve Cishek came off the DL. He pitched last night, the second outing of the season for him. He gave up a home run to Matt Joyce and allowed another run to come home later in the inning, came in to a 5-4 ball game where the Mariners were leading, And when he left the game and everything was said and done, it was not in favor of the Mariners. So what are they going to do with the back end of the bullpen now that Edwin Diaz has been removed from that closer's role? And he has struggled this season.
Yeah, Diaz really has struggled this season. I mean, his command has been not good, and he's given up a lot of home runs. C-Shack coming back should theoretically have kind of nailed things down, but that performance last night was pretty ugly. I don't know. I mean, it's another one of those things where it's like, well, you know, what do you really do at this point? Can the Mariners afford to go out and get somebody? Probably not, but DePoto will at least try. I mean, I would imagine he's probably thinking about 3 or 4 or 5 trades he could make to address the back of that bullpen, but it doesn't look great.
Yeah, I was just looking through who is in that bullpen and who might be worth a shot, and it's just I remember Dan Altavilla looking like a potential setup man type during spring training, and he has walked 8 people to go with 17 strikeouts and has a whip of 2. Let's see, Tony Zitch has been fine, I think, but isn't what you're looking for in the solution probably, but he might be the temporary solution.
I actually really like Zitch. I think he's a pretty good pitcher. His slider is so different from his four-seamer. It's about, I don't know, 15 miles per hour lower in terms of velocity than his four-seamer, which can touch, you know, 96, 97. So I really like him. But, I mean, if Edwin Diaz isn't functioning, that's really not much of anything in that bullpen. And you're stuck with guys like Altavilla, like you were saying. You know, you're not going to give Nick Vincent too much time in the closer role, or the old Scrabble was there, but you know, yes, he's really just a lefty specialist, so not much to work with there. So hopefully C-Sheck will be at least moderately effective.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I know Cervais had toyed around with using Diaz in, you know, to put it as simple as possible, just as leverage dictated, and I don't know if once he's removed from that equation, if you'll see him just play matchups and see how long he can get away with that, but it seems like that might be the way to go, is if you don't have this established closer, you might just be able to play, okay, middle of the order in the eighth, there are two lefties, let's use Zepchinski and then bring in Vincent or Zitch or someone to take it the rest of the way home, but it might free him up a little bit in that way.
Not looking great.
So we talk about Zepchinski. Do you know who Zepchinski gave up a home run to in the game last night?
I would have to assume it could have been literally anybody.
Mark Canna.
Oh, Mark Canna. All right.
Friend of the show.
Friend of the show, Mark Canna. All right. A Mark Canna dinger makes me so happy. Good job. Good job, Mark. Good job, other Mark, in giving up the dinger. Thank you for making my day a little bit brighter.
Adam Rosales also struck out later in the inning, so really just a culmination of the DFA podcast's first 6 shows in this one.
Yeah, it's funny because I think at some point we're going to have talked about so many different players that pretty much any event during any baseball game is going to be like, oh yeah, we talked about that guy in the show. So we should celebrate these while it's actually a thing right now. As opposed to by episode 45, we're going to be like, oh, yeah, you know, literally everybody who we've talked about on the show is, you know, the back end of every major league bullpen and bench. So
the Marlins placed a claim on Christian Colon, and he will be going to Miami from Kansas City. So what do we think about him?
It is mainly amazing to me that the Royals have position players that other teams would want to claim, but
yeah, I mean, if you can't make it in the Royals, especially as a second baseman, I mean, what are you really doing? Colon was such a highly touted prospect when he came into the league. It's shocking to see him wind up, you know, not only not even, you know, on the Royals anymore, but on the Marlins, where a team that ostensibly really doesn't need a middle infielder with D. Gordon and Adeni Hechevarria. So, he's had 19 plate appearances this season, Colon has, and he has been uniquely awful. Well, I wouldn't say uniquely awful because everybody on the Royals has been this bad, but he's got a 176, 222, 176 triple slash line. He's better than this, though, right? I mean, he's never been a good hitter in AAA, really, but he should at least be a reasonable, you know, defensive player, a former shortstop. He should be able to be at least a stopgap utility guy. But if you hit this poorly, you're not going to get a job anywhere, I would think.
No, he used to steal a little bit in AAA and AA, and he hasn't ever really run in the majors. He doesn't have absurd plate discipline. Like, he walks a little bit, doesn't strike out a ton, and should be able to field multiple positions, which is fine. Maybe that's something if the Marlins think JT Riddle needs some more seasoning in the minors, but then they also have Derek Dietrich. So I don't know if Christian Colon's going to see a lot of the field with the Marlins either, but he will probably land somewhere and
this
try
is the
again.
This is the thing I just realized when I was looking up Colon's stats, and it makes me feel so terribly old. He's 28. I thought he was still like, you know, rookie, prospect-y caliber, just like kind of aging out of that. He's 28. I'm so sad right now. I thought for sure he was still 25 or 26.
He has played in AAA in every year since 2012.
That is devastating. That's completely ruined my day. Any goodwill from the Mark Canna homer has just disappeared, because now I feel like I'm old and will eventually, you know, there will be nobody left in baseball that I recognize.
So on that note, so moving forward now, Carlos Gomez hits the disabled list. He got a PRP injection yesterday or day before that. Expected to miss 4 to 6 weeks, but a Rangers outfield that was once thought to have a bunch of depth, where do they go from here?
Gomez is kind of interesting because, you know, once again, it's another one of those things where the Rangers are like the, you know, the Rangers are in the same boat with the Mets, the Mariners, and the Giants, where it seems like, you know, it's just a constant stream of things going wrong. The good news is that I do think the Rangers do have some depth to kind of withstand this. Gomez, you know, he really came at a very inexpensive cost, even considering this offseason when they signed him into that contract. They've got Delino DeShields Jr., who's, you know, not great, but he can stand out there. I'm not sure. I just think this is one of those things that is another blow for the Rangers. I don't know if it's really going to have a huge effect on the team, but it definitely doesn't help them. I just, you know, how many more deals like this can the Rangers suffer before they really are completely out of it?
I think with that rotation, not many. It just really lowers their ceiling. I mean, you used to talk about the Rangers as, oh, well, if this outfielder doesn't work out, or if Adrian Beltre is out for a long time, or if, you know, one infielder goes down, you just had this flexibility of Ryan Rua can be a stand-in at first base for 3 weeks without, you know, the ship going down. Joey Gallo can come up and play third base for a while without ruining your playoff odds. But that hasn't really been the problem. It's just been that everything is at a lower level than maybe we thought, or than it has been in previous years, at least. And now you're looking at a player who can play at a really high caliber and be an actual difference maker being removed from the equation and replacing him with more just like holdovers, which is really not what you need from that offense when you're dealing with the pitching staff that they are.
Yeah. I think in time, you know, if Beltre was able to come back, then you could move Gallo around, like you said. I mean, eventually they could bring back up Jerks and Profar, I guess, but he wasn't playing very well, and Gomez was hitting well. So, yeah, this is going to hurt him. So, Sean, what did the Rangers do to try to fix this?
So the Rangers have signed Drew Stubbs, and he was sent to the AAA Round Rock Express to kind of try to get back into the swing things. They also called up Jared Hoying. Can either of those two guys produce anything like the Rangers need in the outfield?
No.
Yeah, I'm going to go with no.
Drew Stubbs couldn't crack the Giants outfield, which is saying something, and is no longer a good defensive player, which was his defining skill kind of going forward. And Hoying is a complete cipher to me. I mean, he's basically a AAA player as far as I see it, not really much of a major league player.
Yeah, you just really have to hope that the Delino de Shields renaissance happens and that maybe you play... Oh, man, Ryan Rua hasn't been good against anyone. I have no idea. I was going to say play Ryan Rua's preferred platoon split, but I don't think that would help either.
So with Hoying, I absolutely love Hoying because he has been down at the Texas Rangers AAA team, the Round Rock Express, since 2013. He got called up for a cup of tea last year. But on the program, whenever you walk in, he is like the main face. He is Mr. Express. And my brother and I love going to the games and just seeing him. So we went to the Rangers game last night, looked up and saw he was in the lineup. I had no idea he had gotten called up. And I was like, this guy is not going to leave us. He's just not ever going to be away from us. We're going to have to always deal with Jared Hoying.
So this is great. As the premier Jared Hoying expert on this podcast, what are you? Can you give me a scouting report on the guy? I mean, other than being like really great at being on the cover of the Round Rock Express program, what can we expect from him in the major leagues? Is it anything?
Well, he was really bad last night.
Okay,
so.
Great.
So other than that, I got nothing. He's got over 800 OPS in the minors, but yeah, he was not good last night. Going forward, the Rangers have to have somebody if they want to stay in contention. Who do you think that they could go out and get on kind of a short term, just the rest of the season, deal or trade?
I mean, they'd have to get somebody where it requires relatively low outlay on their part, I would figure. Maybe they could try to find a team that would be a taker for Profar. As kind of like a, hey, we need an emergency kind of do-it-all infielder, outfielder type. And maybe that could bring back somebody effective in the outfield who'd at least be an upgrade. My thoughts always, because as a Mets guy, go to the Mets, where a Profar for like Curtis Granderson swap might work out for both teams. You know, that would give them somebody else who's a left-handed bat who could play the outfield. And they could get him for probably a song. They probably wouldn't even have to give up a Profar type. They could give up, you know, I don't know, double A reliever or something like that, or Dario Alvarez or something like that. I don't know. What do you think, Zach? Any other teams or fits that jump out at you?
I was gonna say something about John Jay, but they would have to give up pitching, and they really just don't have any.
Yeah.
So that's a bit of a problem. Oof. I guess if you're looking at Drew Stubbs on the market, you're not doing well. Angel Pagan would have made sense if he didn't retire or decide not to play this year or whatever he did. Gregor Blanco would have made sense before he became the Diamondbacks plan that I think we're going to talk about in a second. There's not a lot of guys that make sense outside of, you know, trading something that maybe is a better solution in and of itself.
Yeah, I'm just thinking at other teams that are kind of out of contention, not playing so well, that might have a disposable piece. You think of maybe like the Brewers, if Brian Braun got healthy, maybe they could move a guy like, and obviously not Keon Broxton, but I don't know, maybe Domingo Santana would be a fit for this Rangers team. But again, you wind up having to give somebody up. And so any move that they make would probably be pretty poor. So I think maybe just moving Joey Gallo to the outfield and swinging with that while they can, and have him play left field once Beltre comes back, if and when. I also like looking at, for guys like Hoying, guys that I know really legitimately nothing about, looking at their comparables on Baseball Prospectus. And if you look at the comparable players to Jared Hoying, you get about eight other guys that nobody's ever heard of, and then Justin Ruggiano is probably the best case scenario, which is that's not good, because his best case scenario was his 2010 season where Ruggiano did you know, just basically nothing.
Ruggiano did say he was going to take over as a center fielder.
That's right. Maybe Ruggiano's got this. Maybe he's got that. But yeah, his most comparable season is Ruggiano's 2010, in which he spent the entire season in Durham, playing for the AAA affiliate for the Rays. So that's not looking great.
So I'm surprised you didn't throw out another Met name that we just all love, and that's Jay Bruce.
Hey.
Could you see the Mets making a move for Jerickson Profar with their love for positional depth and a guy that can play multi-positions and fit anywhere? Could you see them doing a Profar for Bruce?
Not really. I think actually Bruce is playing well enough right now that they would want more. And I think they have an irrational love for Bruce too. I don't know. Zach, what do you think?
I have very much always thought the Mets have an irrational love for Jay Bruce as a person who wrote, I think it was a Beyond the Box Score, I wrote about the ways in which they're, you know, picking up with Bruce's option could really, really harm Conforto's development, which didn't turn out to happen because, or, you know, hasn't so far because they've had so many open holes for Conforto to play in. But I never really understood the level to which they were enamored with Jay Bruce, but he is playing well, and I don't think that, I mean, I think the Mets are closer to contention than the Rangers, and it wouldn't really make sense for them to be the risk-taking side of that deal.
Yeah, relatively quietly, Jay Bruce has the highest true average of his career right now with .314. So I would guess that the Mets are probably just content to say, okay, we're okay with Jay right now, and we'll kind of wait and see. On the other hand, you know, I mentioned Granderson because Granderson's been, you know, really not very good this season. He's got an expiring contract too, so I think that would be a more likely move. But truthfully, I think the Rangers will just wind up holding steady.
So moving on from Rangers talk, we now go out to the West, and the Arizona Diamondbacks sent A.J. Pollock to the disabled list. And for a team that has been somewhat surprising this season, can they keep it going? Who takes Pollock's place?
Well, they are currently running out Ray Fuentes or Gregor Blanco. Ray Fuentes, you might remember from the World Series era Royals. He was the even poorer man's version of Paolo Orlando. And he is apparently going to play center field for the Diamondbacks, at least some of the time. He did not have a comment in the annual this year, so there's that. And he has struck out 60% of his 5 plate appearances so far, so we know nothing. But yeah, Gregor Blanco seems like the more likely answer, who was also a cast-off from the Giants, which is also a bad sign.
Yeah, that is a tough one. I would have to imagine that, honestly, I think probably the best fit at this point is maybe moving Chris Owings back to the outfield. I know he's been playing fairly well at shortstop, but the Diamondbacks have a lot of middle infield depth, with Nick Ahmed, who, you know, can take over and play some, you know, very good defensive shortstop. But they also have Ketel Marte hiding in their AAA lineup, and they've got like 3 or 4 other shortstops that are on their 40-man roster: Domingo Leyba, Jack Reinheimer, Ildemaro Vargas, who, that's a name I've never used before. So they've got some other guys, and then I would hope Socrates Brito would eventually be able to come back. And they've got Jeremy Hazelbaker on the 40 as well. So they actually have an okay amount of depth. The problem is that Pollock's really good, and literally none of the people I've talked about just now are good. So, you know, Ahmed's really not bad. He's fine. And Owings has had a career renaissance this year. So maybe that's the best move. But, yeah, the outfield being a defensive outfield with Peralta, Yasmani Tomas, and Chris Owings out there doesn't seem like it's nearly as nice as the having Pollock kind of in the middle holding it down.
They incredibly also have Daniel Descalso, who can play short and second. And
wow.
they have noted center fielder Chris Herrmann.
He definitely has done that before.
Yes.
Oh, my. Well, on that note, we're going to keep it going and move to a former Arizona Diamondback, and that's Peter O'Brien. He was claimed off of waivers by the Kansas City Royals from the Cincinnati Reds. So do we think that he produces anything in his time with the Royals?
Yeah, speaking of people who have no business playing the outfield, playing anywhere defensively. No, I don't think Peter O'Brien ends up doing anything for the Reds. The Reds have become kind of this staging area for mismatched, you know, damaged prospects. But he was playing poorly at Omaha for the Royals, and I'm afraid that there's just always going to be too much swing and miss in this guy, and there'll never be enough to kind of unlock that incredible power that O'Brien has. But, you know, if there's a place to get a shot, I guess it's Cincinnati.
Yeah, it's interesting the trajectory of his career is he was just, he hit everywhere. He always struck out a lot, but he hit everywhere in the minors throughout his career until he got that, I may be the only person who remembers this, but he got an 8-game cup of coffee with the Diamondbacks in 2015, in which he actually hit. I mean, he literally took 12 plate appearances, but he hit 400, hit a home run, walked 16% of the time, got sent back down, and then was suddenly not good anymore in AAA. He was just an average hitter. He got traded, came up again in 2016 and was terrible in the majors. And now with the Royals in 2017, he has been absolutely awful in AAA with no power. It's not that his strikeout rate went up, it's that he suddenly has no power. And I don't know how to reconcile that other than that he's going to become sort of like Adam Brett Walker, the big power hitter who was on like 7 teams this offseason and suddenly has no power either. So it's not looking great for Peter O'Brien, but yeah, sure, if the Reds have some opening, maybe they'll bring him up and see if he can hit some balls out of that ballpark.
If you look at the Reds bench right now, they have Tucker Barnhart, who was drafted by the team and is a, you know, okay backup catcher. But then the rest of the bench is Stuart Turner, who's a Rule 5 guy, and then three guys who the team has picked up on waivers in Arismendi Alcantara, Scooter Gennett, and Patrick Ivlahan. So they're really good at grabbing these guys on waivers and then putting them on the bench. And, you know, whether or not these players they pick up are effective or not is another issue. But they definitely do exist. So, you know, again, if you're going to get a shot somewhere, maybe it's with the Reds.
Very quickly, if you had to pick one to pinch hit in, let's say it's extra inning games, thus necessitating this, would you rather have Peter O'Brien or Michael Lorenzen pinch hit?
Whew, that's a good question. If I'm at home and I'm the Reds, I would maybe go with Lorenzen for the sheer, intangibles factor that Lorenzen seems to have a little bit of magic in him. But no, normally I will stick with the professional hitter rather than the relief ace.
I don't have an answer. I just wanted to see. I think based on recent results, I might just go with Lorenzen.
Yeah. There's no good answer here. So.
No.
So you talk about the Reds being a staging ground. This was the first place Cincinnati Reds for a lot of the early part of the season. And I can't say that anymore because they have been usurped by the Cardinals. Good Lord, the Cardinals are back in first.
We can't escape the Cardinals. They're just too consistent. It makes me furious that, you know, they have, what, one down year last year where they're not even a bad team, and now back in first place, ahead of the Cubs, ahead of the Pirates. It's shocking.
Now, if they had picked up Peter O'Brien off waivers, I would have just assumed he was going to hit like peak Alan Craig for 2 years, get traded, and then disappear to the minors and never be seen again.
Yeah, the Cardinals devil magic. So, yeah, you gotta keep an eye out. If even the Cardinals can't fix this guy, then he's probably out of luck.
So from the devil magic to a guy who looks like he's a wizard in the offseason, Hunter Pence to the disabled list, and he will miss about a week. But in the meantime, the Giants are charging back. They have 5 games in a row that they have rolled off. They're at 17-24, still well under 500. But is this team alive? Are they going to be able to do anything?
I don't know. The Giants are a mystery every season. There's enough people playing poorly on that team that I think they wouldn't be able to come back from it. I mean, Buster Posey, you know, recently has been better, but he hasn't looked like the same hitter. Pence has been pretty good. He's been his normal kind of pretty good self this season. So if he's going to be out, you know, you have to assume that this injury is not going to be something that's going to keep him out for an extended period of time, but it's also not going to be the only injury he has, because that's just kind of how he is now. He's a player who shows up for, you know, somewhere between 50 and 120 games in a season. I just don't know what to make of the Giants. Maybe you've got something, Zach.
I don't know if you've been watching Eduardo Nunez play left field at all.
Yeah.
It's bad. He is staring at fly balls that go to the left of his glove a little bit and just roll to the wall. and that doesn't seem very sustainable to me. Neither do any of the other players who play outfield for them. Denard Span, it looks like he is approaching grandfatherdom. And the other outfielders are all just like these spare pieces that, like we've been talking about, that the rest of the roster doesn't look bad. I am still of the opinion that Jeff Samardzija is probably not as bad as the results have been looking, but his, you know, everything about the team does not help him really. Cueto is Cueto. Matt Moore has been bad, and the infield is still good. So it's a tricky situation there, and I still don't see them getting to the level where they could really make a run in that division because of the Rockies and the D-backs being at just, you know, better. It's going to be a tough division to really make a run in, I think. But it's possible if the pitchers put it together or something like that, but they need some help in the outfield.
I just realized how stupid I must have sounded, because Posey had a great game last night. And now I thought since he was off to a slow start, he was still playing poorly. But it looks like he's having a real nice run of games recently. His batting average on balls in play is unsustainably high, but he's hitting again. But aside from him and Brandon Belt, those are the only two hitters on the team who are basically above league average at all at this point. Well, and Madison Bumgarner, but you know that hardly matters at this point. But yeah, that's just so strange to me, because with they're a team with, you know, Joe Panik and Brandon Crawford and Hunter Pence. And, you know, some of these guys should be at least hitting a little bit, and it really doesn't seem like anybody is getting it together. What you said about the pitching staff is kind of interesting, because I don't know. I mean, Samardzija has been better than his ERA, I think. But Cueto is the kind of surprising guy to me. I expected him to be just a little bit more effective, maybe not giving up so many homers. Mm-hmm. Maybe that'll kind of straighten itself out. I don't know.
So Hunter Pence has been playing great this season, batting .243, .289 OBP, .338 slugging. You have to think some of the injury factors into it and the injuries he's dealt with this season. But he's never had a year where he slugged under .400, so I ask you both this. What is more likely to happen? Hunter Pence slugs over .400, or Giants fans actually embrace Brandon Belt as being good?
Oh, definitely the Pence one.
Yeah, I it's really tough to imagine that Giants fans will ever truly embrace Brandon Belt. I don't think that's a possibility at this point. But yeah, I think Pence will eventually get back over 400, I think, for his slugging.
So moving forward, we have a topic that Zach really wanted to talk about in this one, and it's Grant Dayton being sent down by the Dodgers. So Zach, have the floor.
Okay, so Grant Dayton was a hobby horse of mine. I just was really in on him as soon as he showed up last year and started taking bigger and bigger situations in the Dodgers bullpen, because I think he has we tend to talk about it a lot in terms of spin rate at this point. He has a rising fastball, a fastball that comes in and it doesn't go as fast as you would expect, but it just looks different to hitters than it ends up being. It ends up above their bat and they swing through it. He threw, looking at Brooks Baseball for his page last year for regular season major league stats in 2016, he threw 363 four-seam fastballs. And of the people, of the hitters who swung at them, 33% of the swings were whiffs on a fastball, which is crazy. I mean, that is just, that's not supposed to happen. And so having that sort of ability and a pitch that moves like that, or just doesn't move like that, it defies gravity, that's something that should, theoretically, when I was looking at him this offseason, that was something that made me think, okay, this guy can stick. This is a skill that's not going to go away. It's kind of the same way you keep seeing Marco Estrada be better than anyone thought he could possibly be for the Blue Jays. And so Grant Dayton being sent down is, he obviously hasn't been very good this year. And so I was poking around his page trying to figure out why. And the movement hasn't really changed, which probably just makes you think I'm crazy for thinking that the movement mattered. But the thing that has changed is the average location of his fastball has dropped from really, really high. You know, he was throwing it up in the zone or out of the zone high near the hitter's letters or eyes, like a lot. That's where he was pounding with that fastball. And this year it's been below the middle of the zone. So he's either missing low or he's trying something new that isn't working. Whatever it is, the type of fastball he's throwing is just not functioning at the in the locations that he's throwing it. It could also be, I think he's had some walk problems this year, so maybe he was having people lay off the high fastball and he's trying something to make them swing again, but that's kind of spitballing. It's just interesting that I don't think the movement's changed. His velocity's down a tick, but not anything that wasn't really his strong suit anyway. So it's interesting. I think if he can go down to AAA, he might be able to figure it out and come back. I'm still on the Grant Dayton train, but that's kind of a blow to the Dodgers bullpen because I still don't think they have a ton of guys who can be as reliable as Dayton was for them last year, but they're the Dodgers, so they have a billion pitchers.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that really jumps out to me about Dayton was that his O-swing is down a lot, so people aren't swinging at pitches outside the strike zone anymore, and that probably has something to do with him no longer working up in the zone and working down in the zone instead. And then once the ball is in the zone, the batters that swing at it are making it contact at a much higher rate, which again talks about, I think, the location matters quite a bit there. So I think you're right on track with that. It's just so funny because it feels like, you know, Dayton was one of these guys this offseason where smart people like yourself, and I think there was an article at Fangraphs about how he could be an elite reliever, and I know Ben Lindbergh talked about him on podcasts, and now it's like, you know, 5 ERA, 5 FIP, not striking anybody out, walking guys, and it's just, I think part of it is a measurement of the volatility of relievers and how quickly things can go south or improve for these kinds of pitchers. And then, you know, the other thing to it is, well, it's still been just like 12 innings and 14 appearances, so you never know. This could be something that really just is an artifact of the small sample, and, you know, he'll come back up from the minors and start throwing really nicely again.
Yeah, I think he missed 10 days with some sort of little injury too, so there are a lot of factors that could be playing in, but the location is really the one that popped out at me, that he needs to throw that fastball high.
Yeah.
So sticking with the Dodgers, we're going to move to the rotation now. Dodgers have activated Brandon McCarthy and Rich Hill. We talked a little about Rich Hill coming off the DL on Tuesday's show, but both have started between shows, so I'll read them to you now. Rich Hill went 5 innings, 6 hits, 1 earned run, 6 strikeouts. He gave up 1 home run in that start. And then yesterday, Brandon McCarthy, 5 and 2-thirds innings, 8 hits, 6 earned runs, 1 walk, 5 strikeouts. So McCarthy, to this point in the season, has 34 and 2-thirds innings. Rich Hill has 13. Which pitcher will pitch more innings for the Dodgers this season?
Man, that's a good question. I mean, both these guys so injury prone, so likely to be under 100 innings for the entirety of the season. And then McCarthy was actually, you know, very bad. It's funny, those lines you just read, I was like, well, for the first one, the Rich Hill start, I was like, oh, that's kind of your typical Rich Hill start, isn't it? You know, relatively short outing. More strikeouts than innings, you know, very few runs given up. And then you read McCarthy's line, and I was kind of like, well, that kind of sounds like a typical Brandon McCarthy start these days too, where he gives up, you know, more runs than innings he pitches. I guess I go with Hill, but you really never know.
I would also go with Hill just because he's still effective. I think his injuries, at least in the nouveau Rich Hill stage,
that's bad.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. I know that he has been, he's had the blister problems and things like that, but overall it hasn't been the season-ending Brandon McCarthy-style fluke or catastrophic injury, so I'll stick with Rich Hill just to keep doing what he's been doing and get to, like, you know, 80 or 100 innings.
I've got my fingers crossed that McCarthy comes out of the rotation and they go with Kershaw, Ryu, Wood, Urias, and Hill for a little while, because, I mean, how often do you see a rotation that's only left-handed pitchers?
Not often.
Plus, Kazmir could come back at some point, so they've got another lefty hanging out. So, yeah, that'd be fun.
So, moving from a left-hander on the Dodgers pitching staff to a left-hander for the Oakland Athletics. That's Sean Manaea. He came off of the disabled list Monday, and his start was all right. Allowed 4 runs, 2 hits, 1 home run, walked 5, and struck out 7 over 5 innings. So a typical Sean Manaea start.
I'm extremely here for Sean Manaea. I really love this type of pitcher, which is, he'll walk the planet. He'll strike out the planet. He's been getting great ground ball rate this season. And then you look at the gap between his earned run average of like 5.5, which is like, oh man, he's terrible, and his DRA this season, which is 1.98. So Baseball Prospectus gives him like over a win of value so far this season on his 6 starts. But, you know, he's in actual practice in terms of giving up runs, he's been very bad. So these are the types of pitchers that are extremely my jam. I love watching him pitch. I'm really rooting for him to have a successful season. I have no idea how it's going to turn out this year.
Yeah, there are a lot of these pitchers right now. We already kind of talked about Salazar, who has a home run problem that Manaea hasn't had this year so far, but there was that Carlos Martinez phase early in the season where he was doing the strikeout 9, walk 6, give up 2 hits thing. And I think that's very much the type of pitcher Manaea is right now, where he might have more walks than strikeouts and like go 6 innings and get a win. I mean, that seems like the type of thing that he's doing. And I don't know that it's the best plan, but it's a plan. It's something that you could work on, and he might eventually get the feel for how to take those 3-1 at bats and 3-2 at bats and turn them into strikeouts or bad contact instead of the walks that he's giving up, even though he loves the slider and the pitches that he throws into the dirt. But it seems like he's a very interesting pitcher that the A's especially should just keep throwing out there and see what happens.
The other thing about Manaea that is really interesting is he's absolute death to left-handed pitchers, or at least he was last year, and he's had pretty nice platoon splits. But this year, he's hardly faced any left-handed hitters, and he's been bad when he has. So I have to think that's going to kind of reconcile itself a little bit. That split will start being regressed to being a little bit more true. And if that's the case, then I would expect you'd see his overall numbers kind of improve a little bit.
Is there a more fascinating rotation than the Oakland Athletics with Sonny Gray, Kendall Graveman and his two-seam, Sean Manaea and his whatever Sean Manaea is, Andrew Triggs and his waiver claimness that has turned into just beauty for Oakland, and then Jesse Hahn at the back end?
And they have Jarrell Cotton in the minors, who was, to my eye, he was a little bit unlucky. He was giving up dingers at a rapid pace, but I think if you look at the types of homers he was giving up, I think he was getting a little bit unlucky there, and I would be interested to see him come back too when one of those pitchers inevitably gets hurt. But
yeah, I think in terms of interesting, the only other comparable rotation right now to, you know, guys that are unproven and got there from weird circumstances and doing strange things and have lots of different looks, the only other team that I see as being comparable at all to that is the Rockies right now, with their 1-2 punch of Tylers at the top of the rotation and Tyler Chatwood and Anderson, and then the three rookies, Senzatella, Freeland, and Marquez at the back of the rotation, and then, you know, John Gray when he's healthy, and you've also got Hoffman kind of waiting in the wings. So that's the only other team, but and of course then they also have to pitch in Colorado, which makes everything a little bit more volatile, I guess, let's put it that way.
Right, the A's have a similar advantage, just a similar advantage to the Rockies' disadvantage, in that the Coliseum should help them suppress home runs. But
sure. Yeah, so those are the two teams that I think definitely have the most fun/interesting rotations to watch right now.
So I got two more moves for you. This one, our famed New York Mets have signed Neil Ramirez. He was the corresponding roster move to placing Asdrubal Cabrera on the disabled list officially. And while they did that, they announced that they will now be running with a 4-man rotation going forward and skipping Sean Gisselman's start.
Well, Neil Ramirez is not going to fix this team's bullpen problem. he was awful for San Francisco. He had an ERA close to 9, and he could perhaps be used better in a bullpen that wasn't badly mismanaged by Terry Collins. I don't think he'll get much run in that bullpen. And if he's at all effective, then Collins will wear his arm out completely and have him sent to the disabled list, I'm sure. So that's not wonderful. It's nice that the Mets finally decided to put Astrubal Cabrera on the DL. That's a good thing. But the four-man rotation on a rotation that's not particularly healthy to begin with is probably not ideal, though. Robert Gesellman's been garbage, so I understand them not wanting to throw him out there. I think you just have to cross your fingers and hope Steven Matz comes back sooner than later. And it sounds like he's recovering well. But yeah, until Matz comes back, it's just going to continue to be a disaster there.
Boy, have you seen Neil Ramirez's ground ball rate?
His career ground ball rate is it's not good, Bob.
No. It's not a recipe for success. He's giving up 1.74 home runs per 9 this year, which is a small sample. I bring this up mainly because in a sample of about double that last year, he pitched 24 innings last year, his homers per 9 was 3.
Oof. Ooh, that's not good at all. Yeah, this is not the kind of, you know, the Mets fans and people who've been watching the team have not been excited with the number of home runs that bullpen's giving up. This isn't going to help things very much.
It's a curious move, too, for a bullpen that has already been taxed a lot at the back end this season to further tax them with the four-man rotation.
Yeah, it's a strange move.
Now we'll move to the final thing, and this one's a little, I guess if you're Cody Ashe, it's not fun, but for us it'll be fun. Cody Ashe outrighted by the Chicago White Sox. And we have a little outfield play to talk about.
Yeah, if you can call it that. So the White Sox, first of all, Cody Ashe, it's not a good sign that Cody Ashe was with the big league team to begin with. He's not what you would consider a particularly effective player, not a great hitter. He washed out in Philadelphia and now has seemingly potentially washed out in Chicago, but Chicago doesn't have that many good options in their outfield, right? I mean, this is not what you would consider a high quality outfield, would you?
No.
So that's the short of that. So they've been even running out an all Garcia outfield with Avisail Garcia, who's, you know, he's had actually a pretty nice start to the season, but has a very bad pedigree in right field. Leury Garcia has been playing some center field because they can't keep a center fielder healthy. And Willie Garcia has been spending some time in left field when Melky Cabrera's had to sit. And so the all-Garcia outfield, while fun from a name perspective, has not been fun from an effectiveness perspective. But the play that you wanted to talk about was last night. Leury Garcia, it was in the 11th inning, Albert Pujols hit what looked like a relatively innocuous fly ball to center field, but Garcia was playing shallow. He ran back to get it. Somehow, the ball managed to go past his glove, hit Garcia in the shoulder, and he went down like he was shot. And that was your walk-off. The Angels won in the 11th inning on what was called a single, even though it bounced off the center fielder's torso, and the Angels won the game. We'll put a link to the highlight for this because it's a bit odd, but yeah, this was a pretty good microcosm of what the White Sox outfield really looks like these days,
which is sad and somewhere past the realm of darkly comic. I mean, it was. It was like he was the last guy standing in a dodgeball match, and when he got hit, he wanted to make it look especially dramatic since it was going to end the game, and he succeeded.
Yeah, it was a nice moment for Albert Pujols because, you know, you don't know how many of these walk-off kind of hits he's got left in his career, but it was really ugly. I feel bad for White Sox fans at this point. They really need some, you know, certifiable center field help, because I don't think Leury Garcia is the man for the job.
No. And that we were watching the video before we recorded. And the interesting thing is clearly the Angels had prepared to mob whoever walked off the game, and it was Pujols. So they come out with their water bottles and their powder. I guess that's rosin. I don't remember. Flour? Is it flour? I don't remember exactly what they throw on the people who walk off. But they had all of it ready, and they went ahead with it and mobbed Pujols when he did very little to deserve it other than put the ball in play at exactly the right person on the White Sox.
So good for him, bad for Larry Garcia. You got to just hope, I guess, that somebody like Charlie Tilson gets healthy, or the team just folds entirely and we don't have to watch plays like that ever again.
So the White Sox have a better record than four teams in the American League. Can you guys name them?
I mean, off the top of my head, I would have to think the Rangers are one.
The Royals are one.
Oh, yeah.
The Rangers are not one. The Rangers are at 500.
0-1 for me, but at least we got the Royals right, right?
Yes, the Royals is one.
Do the Blue Jays still have a worse one?
Blue Jays are another one.
The Rays?
The Blue Jays are one. The Rays are not one.
Good, so good. So
we're
so
Royals and Blue Jays.
So Zach's been right on both of his. I've been wrong on both of mine. This is good. All right.
The Rangers really being helped by that 7-game win streak.
Yeah, yeah. Blue Jays, Royals.
I can currently only think of four teams in the AL West, so that's not good.
Are the Mariners still below them?
By 9/1000 of a winning percentage point.
All right. That would mean the A's.
Yep,
right?
And the A's.
Okay.
The A's, Mariners, Blue Jays, and Royals. And if we went to the National League, there's a lot more of them, so we'll just avoid that altogether.
Well, the entirety of the National League East, it seems like, is probably below them.
Literally the Mets, Braves, Marlins, and Phillies, all well below them.
Oh, man, that is sick. That is so bad.
I mean, we've actually done all but three now, so there's only three left in the National League if you guys want to finish it up.
You can take that one, Zach. I can't even think at this point.
Padres, Pirates, and...
2-for-2.
Giants?
3-for-3.
Ooh. Ah, excellent. Well, I think that we've, judging from my performance in guessing things and my ridiculous Buster Posey comment, Zach, you've officially earned the right to replace me as host of this show going forward, because you've had some great insights, and I've just been awful today. So, well done.
Well, I've made all up for that with my Rich Hill pun, so we're probably even.
Yeah, that's a good point. In that, you've done a wonderful job substituting for RJ, who every episode makes some sort of terrible pun that makes me want to just curl up in a ball and feel terribly sorry for myself. So well done there. I appreciate it.
That is his hill to die on.
Oh, guys, I have to end this show now. This is unacceptable behavior. And we will all fire ourselves at the end of this show. So Zach, let's give you the opportunity to plug anything you've got in the pipeline or your Twitter account or anything else you want to plug.
Sure. You can follow me at Z Kreiser on Twitter, and I write once a week at Baseball Prospectus. You should just go to Baseball Prospectus, not necessarily for me, but there's a bunch of stuff going on there that's really good all the time. So just go check that. You'll see my work when it's there. And, yeah, you can follow me on Twitter if you like getting tweet links to the stories I write at Baseball Prospectus. So
everybody likes tweet links. How yes. Could you not love tweet links? I certainly agree with Zach. You should go to Baseball Prospectus. There is a podcast there that you are already listening to, DFA Podcast. You can find that on Twitter at DFA Podcast. So we are almost ready to be on iTunes. We've got everything in the system, so we're just waiting for that wonderful email that'll let you know that we're finally up and running on iTunes. But you can find the show at the site. Subscribe to Baseball Prospectus, please. Keep us running. But in the meantime, we will see you for our next show. Take care.